For August 10th, 2017, it's the Lullabot Podcast. Lullabot Podcast.
Hey, everybody. It's the Lullabot Podcast, episode 214. I'm Matt Cleve, senior developer at Lullabot. With me, as always, senior front-end developer, Mike Herschel. Hey, Mike.
Good afternoon, hey, Matt Cleve.
Good afternoon, Mike Herschel. So, hey, you know, on the podcast, we've always kind of had this front-endy, back-endy thing going between us, right? We kind of have different expertise areas.
Until today,
because I don't jack about what we're talking about. But I think it's going to be a good learning experience for me and for our listeners, right?
Gotcha, yeah.
Because I know that as I've been at Lullabot over the last several years, we've definitely kind of differentiated within the staff. There are those unicorns that kind of, you know, are on both sides of the line, but we have front-end developers, we have back-end developers, and never the two shall twain, or however that goes.
You're just pulling stuff out of your back-end there?
So, exactly, yeah. And so tell me exactly, so today we're going to be pulling things out of our front end. We're going to talk about the current state of front end development, because it seems like every project I get on, I've got no clue all of the tools that are being used and all of the, you know, stuff that's out there. So we're going to just kind of go through it and learn about what's the latest, greatest, what are front end developers using these days, and how it helps out in your project.
Awesome. And with us today, we have two amazing front-end developers here at Lullabot. Let's go ahead and start with front-end developer Mark Drummond, who's from the beautiful city of either Minneapolis or St. Paul, but somewhere up in the...
It's the St. Paul of the side of the Twin Cities.
The better side?
It's fighting words to say I'm from Minneapolis.
Is that the evil twin or is that the good twin?
Oh, St. Paul's the best of the Twin Cities. Okay. Everybody knows that.
Okay.
No, sorry, I didn't answer the question. Mark is a Drupal 8 core developer, has a lot of work on the front end in DA, including like a lot of work on responsive images. I'm sure you have some other front endy stuff in Drupal 8, and he's also really awesome person. Welcome, Mark. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Hi, glad to be here.
Hey, Mark. Also with us. Super. Also with us, we have senior front-end developer at Lullabot. He's got a pack of dogs and a background in design and art. He went back to Ohio and his city was gone. Hey, it's Wes Ruvalcaba. What's going on?
Hey, yeah. I do things, and I do have an entire fleet of dogs, yeah.
So you also have experience working with Backdrop, right?
Yep.
Backdrop Core and its front-end.
Yep, do a lot of work on the front end with them, especially on the admin side with Seven, and created a new default theme to replace Bardic.
And you like nerding out with all of the latest, greatest, you know, tools these days?
Yeah, I used to. I'm getting a little more curmudgeonly, but yeah, we can talk about that in a bit.
Where does the front end start and the back end end? Where's that dividing line? It's getting a little bit murkier as, you know, Node is server side and things like that. I'll let Mark go first.
Yeah, I think that line can be kind of squishy. So, you know, I'd describe front end development in general as the work of taking the data for a site and taking the raw data and putting it into markup and CSS and JavaScript to create a particular experience from a designer, as well as the interactions. So mostly dealing more with the client side. But where that exact line gets drawn in terms of how the markup is created, I think gets squishy. And, you know, we deal with primarily the markup coming from the back end of Drupal. Mm-hmm. But we also have a lot of great developers who are assembling that markup on, you know, with JavaScript frameworks and that sort of thing. And so I think yeah, it's a little bit squishy where exactly that line is, but that's how I'd describe it.
Wes, do you have an easy way to describe the difference between a front end and a back end, and where's that line?
Yeah. Yeah, to me, it's if you're writing code that has to do with the user interface, it's front end. whether it's, you know, PHP or that's spitting out HTML or, you know, Node or whatever it is, if it's spitting out something that's going to be part of the user interface, that's front end to me. And then the more you're just dealing with data that's being handled on the server or data that's being handled in the background, the more back-endy it is to me.
Yeah,
I think that's fair. I was thinking, you know, from a strict point of view, like the front end could say everything that gets handled in the browser, you know. But when you're dealing with like server-side rendering systems like Drupal or WordPress or something like that, you have all this logic, or not markup, that's being generated by Drupal, and affecting that's definitely a front end task. I like that delineation right there.
I think where it gets particularly messy is where the data that, say, Drupal has available for you as a front end developer in the theme by default may not be exactly what you need. You may need a date in a different format. You may need a particular bit of data, but not another bit of data. And so as to who does that work of getting the content for the markup exactly what you need and getting the markup exactly right, sometimes that does fall on a back-end developer may be the right person to massage that data. And sometimes it's, you know, something that a front-end developer can do. It sort of depends on, we're individuals, we're people, we have different skill sets. And so where that line falls for certain people may be different.
That brings up like a really good topic here, is like maybe front end workflows specifically with Drupal. I've been on a couple different projects where I've literally kind of created some markup, put it in a gist, sent that to a background developer, and I said, all right, this component, I want you to have this markup with this, you know, BEM style classes and all this type of stuff.
All right, for somebody who came from the grunge era, explain that one to me.
All right, so the grunge era. So BEM style classes is kind of like Nirvana as opposed to Soundgarden, okay, with a little bit of Alice in Chains thrown in.
All right.
BEM is.
But BEM would really be like the Foo Fighters, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, Dave Grohl was everywhere, right? BEM stands for Block Element Modifier, and it's basically a way to write your CSS classes. And so you'll have your component, which is a very beginning part of the class, and then you'll throw a couple underscores in there, and then you'll have like your element that's underneath, and then you'll throw a couple dashes in there afterwards, and that's your modifier.
That a front-end developer can be particularly picky and snobbish about how their markup looks.
That's exactly why we do it. The only reason that we do it is like to piss off backend developers.
Okay.
Yeah, can we be like, hey, listen here, chump. You should use underscores where you should use the dashes.
But it needs to be two underscores at times, right?
Always.
Well, yeah, and unless the moon is full.
It's a name convention that gives you really low specificity, so you don't get into like really nasty, like gnarly CSS selectors. So you don't have like, you know, node dash article space field name dash field blah blah blah, and like, you know, three different selectors to get the right thing, instead of it's one class. So if you have to override it later, you don't need four class names instead of the three you had to use to originally get to it. It keeps everything a lot more maintainable.
Yeah, and it keeps everything componentized pretty well too. So you can be more confident when editing or ripping out part of your CSS, knowing it's not going to affect other parts of your code base.
Yeah, and I'd say, so it may seem like we're picky sometimes about getting our markup and our CSS just so. But there's really good reasons to do that. If you have clean markup with just the classes that you need and just the elements that you need, it is easier to make your markup more accessible, for one. It's easier when you need to debug something to be able to look into your browser dev tools and understand what's going on. There are fewer, if there's a bunch of extraneous divs and classes in there, it's harder to reason about where our particular styles coming from. When you get into some more complicated CSS, the layout of your elements gets way more complicated if there's extra divs that are in there. And then your CSS tends to get more complicated. So it it may seem we're just like very picky, but like there's solid reasons for us to do that.
So getting back on track, let's kind of go back to the workflow question where in different projects, like I've made up the markup and maybe mock things out first. In other projects, I'm kind of writing it like as a backend developer would. How do you two work on that? And is it a project by project thing? Do you have preferences?
So my preference is, to start, I love to be able to mock up markup on its own before I get into any sort of theming code. So I love using, you know, there's lots of tools. Pattern Lab's probably the one that I like the most for being able to easily, quickly just, hey, here's the markup that I want. And then later, as a later step, try to integrate that in with the markup that Drupal is outputting personally. And personally, I like getting into the nitty-gritty of that, of getting Drupal's markup just the way I want it. And, you know, but everybody's workflow's different. That's what I like to do.
Yeah, so I'm actually in a kind of different position. So my first project with Lullabot, I had the wonderful Dave Reed I worked with on a couple things, and I just kind of said, okay, here's kind of what I want to be working with in the end, and let me know if there are any issues. I think it was a TV schedule that we worked on together. And then so he ended up giving me exactly what I wanted, and I didn't, you know, nothing came up. It was great because Dave Reed's amazing. but then after that project, I've been on more what I like to call rescue projects, where the site's been around for a while and they want something to be different or something's not working well. So it's kind of working with an existing system, and you don't want to completely deviate from what they have, so, because then it gets confusing where you have multiple ways of doing things. So in that case, it's more, okay, you guys in the back end just get it working with whatever, and it'll spit out whatever, and I'll handle it. I think that's where a lot of Drupal sites are, where, you know, you might not have as big a team or someone who's dedicated front end. So you just kind of like get Drupal to spit out the functionality, and then you figure out, okay, do I need to change classes or do I need to change markup to some? And yeah, so I've done a lot of that. And then also recently I just built a site on my own. I had to do all the back end and front end work, and there wasn't that much back end work, thankfully, because I don't like being out of my depth. But with that one, it was a brochure kind of site. It was a small, like, six pager. And I think, again, for that one, it was just kind of, okay, let's see what I have. And I ended up using Paragraph since it was a small site, and I didn't have to worry about logged in users or any sort of performance concerns. We could just cache it like crazy, and it'd be fine. And then I ended up looking at Paragraph, and okay, that's not, you know, this gives me like a good base from an editorial kind of perspective, but it did not give me the markup I want at all, which isn't its fault. And so I just, at that point, I just started overwriting templates and, you know, kind of wrote those from scratch to be exactly what I wanted. And yeah, so, I mean, there's a million ways to get the job done. On none of my recent projects, I haven't been able to do anything cool like Pattern Lab, you know, which is really fun, and I've done it before, but it's been a very long time. So, and it still works. I mean, it's still, you know, use the tools for your situation, you know.
Tell me about Pattern Lab. What is it, Wes?
Pattern Lab is, so BEM is a way to name classes, whereas Pattern Lab is a way to think about the design and how you break down elements of the website. So different levels of things, like by size.
But that's like atomic design, though, is what mm-hmm. you're thinking. Pattern Lab, though, is like that's the true. Application.
Yeah. So that was atomic design. Pattern Lab is a style guide builder, static site builder that is meant to make a style guide that will kind of give you an inventory of all of the components you have, and then it by default organizes them in Brad Frost's kind of atomic design structure that he had, and you can add to it, override it, change it completely. Mm-hmm. And it's a really quick way to get stuff going.
Give me an example of these components type things. So like a list, like a picture with a caption, like what kind of things are, would it?
If you think of a website, right? Think of like the header of a website. Yeah. You've got a header of your website. You've got a footer of your website. The header might have like the branding part, like logo and the name of your site. You probably have some sort of navigation elements as part of your header. You might have like a area with a search icon and a search field. Your footer is probably going to have some, you know, copyright information, probably going to have some sort of links and things like that. So each of those, you know, the header itself is a component, but then each of those smaller sections is its own component. So the navigation might be a component. And then you may break the navigation down further into smaller components, like a drop-down, a pull-down menu, something like that. And so what I like about Pattern Lab is that it lets you break things down into smaller and smaller pieces, and you can have one template for each of those pieces, and then you can easily reassemble, you can put multiple pieces together without having to rewrite the markup each time. And you can use Twig for Pattern Lab. There's a Twig version of Pattern Lab. And so as we, you know, move into the D8 world and things, I find that really convenient. You can also use some other templating languages like Mustache, but Twig's fun.
And there's other alternatives of Pattern Lab too. Like KSS is something that does something similar. I haven't used it.
KSS, that means keep it simple, stupid, right?
Nile Style Sheets is what it stands for in the front end world. Oh. And that,
come on, Cleve.
and the way that one tends to work is that you put we use SAS generally, syntactically awesome style sheets, as kind of a, you know, style sheet language to make it easier for it to work with CSS. And we tend to break those into partials, which is one file for the styles for a particular component on the page. And with KSS, you tend to put the markup for a particular component at the top of the SAS partial in a specific format where you can give it a name and that sort of thing. And then KSS can go through then and build a style guide based on the information that you provided in your style sheets. And I've used that on projects as well. And that works too. There's a lot of different ways to do this. I'd say those are probably two of the most prominent ones that I see in the Drupal world these days, though.
It seems like this is something that's moving at a pretty rapid pace as far as improvement to the tool set and you know, different and new and more awesome ways to do things. Yeah.
Yes.
There's always changes. I think there's been a little bit of stability over the last couple of years, mm-hmm. maybe in terms of the tool sets that I tend to be working with when I'm working in a Drupal theme, for example. It hasn't been changing quite so rapidly.
Yeah, it has definitely slowed down.
So when I, on the back end, come into a new project and I have to set up all of your new tools, I usually have to install a bunch of different stuff on my local to make it work. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of just become one of those like, well, yeah, there goes a couple hours because I'm not exactly sure what version of this and what version of that. And something isn't going to work quite right, so I'm going to end up having to talk with Mike or Wes or Mark for a while and get it all figured out. So I was actually, this week I'm doing some work on lullabot.com, which is the most over-engineered blog ever. And I was installing it and it was running a grunt process and there was something that spat out that said, hey, you really shouldn't use grunt anymore. It's like, wait, I just learned what grunt was like 6 months ago or something. So now I'm being told I shouldn't actually use it. It's like, you should actually use Yarn on your new projects. So.
Oh, yeah.
Would you agree?
Whatever. Okay. It still works. It's fine. If it's not going on your production server, there's no security risk, I would say, unless there's something arcane that someone knows about. Yarn is a NPM replacement, not a grunt replacement, though. And
well, Yarn is on top of NPM. You know, Yarn uses NPM, is my understanding. And the benefit of Yarn is that it does lock files, similar to like a Composer lock. I don't know if you're familiar with Composer, Matt Cleese.
It's built on the same system as NPM, but it is an NPM replacement.
It is.
I got you. See, yeah, I was even confused with what the hell I was doing. So.
So to take a step back,
these error messages NPM, weren't helpful.
NPM stands for Node Package Manager.
Yes.
And so
I'm familiar
these
with
are,
that one. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So the so NPM packages are, you know, lots of little bits of code that you know, ultimately they're running on JS, but they're running on your local machine or on a server, but generally on your local machine that are doing little things that are helpful. And so with any package management system, like Composer is one example on my Mac, I use Homebrew for Mac packages. One of the advantages is that if you have multiple people working on the same project, you want to make sure that you have the same version of everything on everybody's machine, because then you can feel confident that everybody's getting the same results and you don't have somebody saying, well, it works for me. And then you don't know if it works for you because you have different stuff on your computer. And so Yarn puts a little file that says, here's exactly the version that we're using for this. And that way it kind of helps ensure consistency. The latest version of NPM, I think it's NPM 5, if I remember right, has introduced something similar to that. From my understanding, and also runs a lot.
I was going to say it was 5 yesterday. I think it's up to 6 today. It may 7.
Is it?
and as funny as that sounds, Mike, that's one of the pain points I've found is you need the right versions of stuff. So, Mark, the last project I was on with you, we needed a specific version of Ruby, or otherwise it wouldn't work. So I learned about the Ruby version manager, and you know, tried to RVM. Remember that what version number we were using, and you know, had to run RVM use whatever number it was.
And there's NVM as well.
Exactly. Node. Hey, you know where I'm going with this. So I set up lullabot.com and I needed a specific version of Node. And I'm like, well, crap, how am I going to do that? Turns out the NVM exists. And I'm like, well, I learned how to use RVM, so NVM can't be that much different. Turns out it's not, but it's kind of annoying.
It's quite nice. It is also annoying.
One thing that's helpful, I think, that's happened in maybe I'd say the last year and a half within the front-end world is that SAS has moved to generally being used as libsass, which is not using Ruby anymore. So before you had all these Ruby gems and you had different Ruby versions, and that was a big layer of complexity. And if you're working on an older project, you may still come across that. But in newer projects, you tend to not have that layer of difficulty, and SAS compiles much faster with libsass than it did with the Ruby versions of SAS. So that's kind of handy.
It's a better way to concatenate a string.
Yeah, it is a better way to concatenate a string. It's faster. let's kind of switch gears here. I feel like we're going down all these rabbit holes, and we're going to do this entire podcast. And it's going to be awesome. So here's the new rabbit hole for us. So Bootstrap, Foundation, or nothing. What about grid systems like SUSE? And we can even get into CSS grids. Who wants to go first?
Got it.
All right.
Yeah, I've been a defender of using Bootstrap and stuff, and I think Mark's in a similar boat as well, where it's not that we necessarily want to use it for every project. I don't think it's great for every project, but it's fine. And you hear a lot of like really popular front-end devs and really like talented people like down it all the time. Or at least I see it a fair amount, not too bad. I think it's calmed down a little bit. But we use it in Backdrop. We use Bootstrap grid system only. And we took Bootstrap Forge grid system, which I think is in beta now, where it's getting close. And that has been really helpful. Backdrop in general is going towards more of a utility class system. So what I mean by that is, if you want something to behave or look a certain way, you just add a certain class to it, and then it, you know, just works TM. So you know, Bootstrap is pretty much all utility classes. You have, you know, container, and which is like, you know, it'll wrap a large section of the page or the whole page. And then you have row, which is just one row of things. And then you have column, and then you specify how many columns you want and at what breakpoint. And then it, you know, it just kind of works for you. And so that's been really great for Backdrop, because they have a panels-esque kind of layout system that you can just go in and say, oh, I want this block to be this many columns in the layout, or I want, you know, if you're making a new layout, you can specify the number of columns that that part of the template should be. And it just kind of works. You don't have to worry about it too much. And then they've also gone through and figured out a lot of the bugs with Flexbox, and because Flexbox has less issues than Float, even though, you know, rabbit hole, but even though Flexbox isn't necessarily meant for page layout, it is still the best thing available that works in the most amount of browsers at the moment.
I think I almost understand Flexbox. Can you just kind of give me the 30-second version?
Yeah, so basically, floats have never been meant for page layout. We've been using them because it's the best thing we have.
Yeah, and then there's float drop and a pain in the ass. And yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah. Right, yeah, totally terrible. So Flex is really good at making one row of things, and you don't necessarily have to specify widths, but you can. And you can also specify some things stretch and some things shrink and this, that, and the other thing. It's not the most intuitive. There's a amazing, if you Google CSS
tricks,
Flexbox.
Flexbox guide.
Like everyone I talk to has that open all the time.
Yep, absolutely.
I'll concur. I would like to venture that is probably the most popular page on CSSTricks.com.
Yeah,
the Flexbox article.
It's got to be.
Chris, if you're listening, let us know. it can also do multiple rows of stuff, but there are some bugs in certain versions of certain browsers, Safari being one of them.
Is this being done with fancy CSS or JavaScript, or what's it actually?
CSS. It's a CSS. This is all CSS, but it's so fancy you might think it was JavaScript.
Yeah.
But it is just CSS, and it works remarkably well if you can figure it out.
Okay.
You can pretty much know enough to be dangerous by looking at the one CSS tricks page.
And there's some fun tools out there like Flexbox Froggy.
Yep.
Where you're basically doing using Frogger to learn how to use Flexbox. And there's some fun little games. Yeah.
So the reason why we use that in Backdrop, system in Backdrop, is because the people that we are trying to appeal to, aren't necessarily CSS wizards, and we don't want them to have to worry about that. And if you have a project that has a lot of devs who might not have, or even like very few devs, but there's not like a CSS wizard, systems like Bootstrap and Foundation will be better than what you would probably be able to get to otherwise, and it's going to save your sanity. So that's kind of the situations where I look at, okay, this is a really good idea to be using this kind of a system. Otherwise, I do generally prefer to hand roll my stuff, and I hate Suzy grids with a passion.
Here.
I'm have done. Some disagreement on that one.
Yep, I'd love to hear.
So we have a lot of tools for front-end development, right? And I think, as Wes kind of just said there, it's important to know your tools, what they do, and what they're good for, and when to use one tool and when to use another tool. And so I think that Bootstrap and Foundation are great tools for when that's the right tool for the job. I think the way Backdrop is using it makes a ton of sense. Because, you know, as Wes said, you know who's going to need to be doing things. Are people going to have a bigger skill set at writing CSS or being able to change some HTML and quickly get something up? And knowing for this particular project, what are the time constraints on it? For something where it's a shorter length project, and you have a limited amount of time to make something look really good, Bootstrap or foundation are probably going to let you get more things up faster that look nice. I've been on one project where I use foundation. I've been on a number of projects where they're longer term projects and where the focus is really around having a very customized design that a designer has put together and custom behaviors. And for something like that, where you have a large enough team and you have a large enough time, I would say Bootstrap and Foundation are probably not the best tools for that particular situation, because there are so many defaults that are built into Bootstrap and Foundation that you'll find yourself doing so much time overriding those defaults that you probably would have been better off starting off from scratch. So if you have the team and the time and the goals for a project where it makes sense, then writing things from scratch is probably going to serve you well. In that circumstance, I've used Suzy Grid quite a bit on most of my projects. We do a lot of grid-based designs, and Suzy works pretty well. You need to it's a float-based system, and I've tried to find times to use Flexbox, and I'm really hoping that we can start using CSS Grid on projects, because CSS Grid is definitely the replacement for how Suzy gets used most. And it's actually very well supported in browsers already. Like, they all came out at the same time. Chrome, yep. Safari, and Firefox all support CSS Grid, and IE Edge, they are working on getting the updated spec supported. I would guess maybe this fall, or if not early next year, it'll probably be supported there as well. And there's ways to do good fallbacks for that. This spring, I did a lot of exploration of CSS Grid and like read a ton of different articles that were out there. Rachel Andrew and Jen Simmons have been kind of leading the way, and they've both shared tons of resources. And so I did that, and then I put together kind of like an experiment where I use CSS Grid to recreate this like French movie poster using Grid.
Yeah, I remember seeing your Twitter post on that, I think. Your tweets, if you will. That's pretty cool. I honestly still haven't UCSS Grid. I'm kind of like, from my point of view, is, you know, my project's still supporting Internet Explorer 11. I'm not going to be able to use it anytime soon. And if I have to write the fallback, well, I may as well write the fallback for everything, you know?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I get it. And it sort of depends on time, but there are good ways to write fallbacks that aren't, they're not that onerous. And so you just have to kind of decide, like, especially once Edge is supporting it. I think it's going to be a very high percentage for CSS Grid. And so getting it looking good with that, it may have fewer bugs design-wise than using floats. And you may be able to get something up pretty good. And then, you know, put in some, you have to decide, does it need to look exactly the same in IE11? Or can it look good in IE11, but maybe not exactly the same. And with some of our clients, it may need to look exactly the same. But IE11 is decreasing in usage, so we'll see.
Yeah, cool. I love the graceful degradation where I don't have to be pixel perfect on every browser. I just think it's awesome.
Well, to me, that's like modern technology or like modern front-end development in general. Even though like my current project doesn't support, you know, IE11, only supports IE11, you know, I still occasionally will look at the site in like IE9, and if there's something that's like completely broken, it's an easy fix, I'll definitely do that. It doesn't have to look perfect, but as long as it's usable, you know, I think that's, you know, just for that, I don't know, 0.001% of people.
Yep.
You know. So, I don't know. Let's talk browsers. Do you have any favorite browser, and why is it Chrome? I'll talk to...
The answer is no.
My answer is yes, and it's definitely Chrome.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. It's still the fastest for me on my system, and the debug tools keep getting better.
And now, Wes, you use Windows, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yep. And Safari is terrible, and I hate it. Oh, my goodness. The Flexbox bugs in Safari are bad. It's really bad. But I think the versions that have the worst bugs are starting to go away, thankfully.
I have this saying about Safari that I think is kind of funny. Like, Safari supports everything very shittily. Like, all the check boxes go down, and then you get onto all these weird edge cases.
Yeah, it has so many asterisks next to supports. Yeah, totally agree.
So, I like Chrome DevTools. For DevTools, that's certainly my favorite. But for everyday browsing, I do like Safari a lot. Mm-hmm. I think it's got some nice features. And yeah, Safari bugs do kind of they're very frustrating.
Yeah, they ruin your day.
They do. Firefox has been doing some cool things lately, and particularly in relation to CSS Grid, they've been building better dev tools for CSS Grid than Chrome has at present. I would say some really nice stuff. And
you know what I was thinking about doing? So, like, I like the idea of Firefox. You know, like, I feel like I already give too much data to Google. Google has my photos, they have my email, they have, like, they know my innermost thoughts before I can even think of it. And, like, I like the idea of the Mozilla Foundation, because it's, like, you know, free, open source, you know, all that good stuff. So what I was going to do, and maybe either Mark or Wes, you would like to do this with me, let's do a week and don't use Chrome developer tools and only use Firefox developer tools. I mean, it would take a lot longer, so, you know, maybe something like, you know, when you're not under the gun, but I think it'd be a fun thing, and I bet we would learn a lot.
Yeah, actually, I think their dev tools, they've been recently improved. I think they are probably better at this point, but I don't have the add-ons that I have in Chrome, I don't think. They might all be there, but I think there might be a few that are missing. For example, the one that will take the theme debug from Drupal and turn it into, like, a little widget in the side pane. Like, I don't know that is in Firefox. Not that it wouldn't be that bad to port, but I just have all my nice warm blankets in Chrome already. But the one thing Firefox is amazing at, if you ever have this problem, if you need to know exactly what font something is and if it came from your local system or a web font, Firefox. It will tell you that. It has a pane for font, and it is awesome.
Chrome will tell you the rendered font, like, underneath all the styles. It just says rendered font, you know, this, that, and the
rendered
other.
Font or computed value?
No, it'll actually tell you the rendered font.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can get into this right now. I'm kind of doing it. So you go into your developer tools, and it's on the elements tab. You go to the computed, and then underneath of everything, you select your element, and it will show the rendered font at the bottom, I believe. Let me find something.
The thing that's been driving me bonkers in Chrome lately is that we work with a lot of responsive design, right? So we're resizing our browser windows all the time. In Chrome, every now and then, when you make your browser window small and then you bring it back open again, the URL bar disappears. And you either have to restart Chrome, or you have to, like, pull all the tabs out of that particular window so that they have a URL bar again, because reasons.
Sounds like Mac problems. I haven't seen that one. But I did see the rendered fonts, and you are correct. That is awesome.
Yeah. All the new stuff that is in Chrome Developer Tools is pretty fun. I give talks on that just because I really enjoy that. And every time there's a new version, I look at the change log and go exploring and stuff like that, and I feel it's a lot of fun. I am still going to do the Firefox a week with Firefox, though.
I think I might try that with you. Yeah,
and then we could kind of, like, you know, teach each other stuff. You know, maybe learn something down the road. That'd be cool.
All right. Well, I'm glad that you were able to break up the Chrome Love Fest that we're having on the Lullabot Podcast. Coming up soon, we're going to talk a little bit about what we call ourselves and look a little bit more into JavaScript and libraries that are being used. Coming up right after this.
Oh, hi. Hi.
Senior developer and trainer Joe Schindelar from Drupalize Me. How are you, Joe?
I'm good. How are you?
Joe, you're from the Twin Cities area, which is the evil twin.
I'd have to say St. Paul is definitely the eviler of the two. I feel like this might be a loaded question.
So what's going on at Drupalize Me these days?
We've actually been really busy making some tweaks and improvements to our site. And, over the last year, we've been so heavily focused on content that we haven't been making many changes to our site. And we've done a couple of things recently that I think are pretty cool. One of them is, like, it seems really minor, but we added last updated dates to all of the tutorials on our site. Which, right, it's like, oh, that's Drupal. You just click a button and ta-da, you can display the last updated date. But we had like 3 or 4 years of discussion about whether or not we should actually display when we last updated the content. And I think that the reason that we landed on yes, we should, is that, you know, it helps people feel more confidence in the material that they're reading on our site when they can look at it and say like, oh, this was updated recently or kind of in line with the most recent release of Drupal and that kind of thing. We're adding some more tools like that to the site that make it easier for people to understand, like, yes, this particular tutorial is up to date, or no, this one is actually out of date and we know that, so proceed with caution until we get around to updating it sometime in the future.
Which tutorial these days is the popular tutorial?
Our Migrate API and sort of like Drupal Migrate stuff for Drupal 8 has been super popular for probably the last like half a year or so. That's kind of been the most popular content on our site. So apparently there's a lot of people that are either moving from some other platform to Drupal or are working on upgrading their Drupal 6 and 7 sites to Drupal 8.
Joe, one thing that I like about Drupalize Me is that you do all the work for me. in that learning isn't always easy, and you have already gone through that process and figured it out and you know, have winnowed it down to a point that it's easily understandable. What was the hardest thing that you had to learn about Drupal 8 that you've made a tutorial about and it's on there now?
Oh, man.
Because there's some tricky stuff out there.
I think for me, the hardest thing has just been kind of wrapping my head around some of the object-oriented programming things that are part of Drupal 8. Because it's not something that I had done prior to learning Drupal 8. And what's interesting about a lot of those things is it was really tricky for me to initially kind of wrap my head around them and place them into the sort of like what I need to know about them in order to be a Drupal developer. But then once you learn the patterns, like dependency injection, it's like this really scary, oh, how am I ever going to learn that? And then you learn it and you're like, oh, that's not actually that bad now that I understand what it is and how to use it. It was just kind of getting over some of that FUD and understanding like this isn't as daunting as it sounds.
There are no syringes involved.
No.
Thanks, Joe.
You bet.
Welcome back to the Lolobot Podcast, episode 214. We're talking about front-end development. We were going to do a front-end roundtable, but we are actually doing a front-end triangle because there are three front-end developers, and then off sitting at his own table is Matt Cleave, all sad in the corner.
No, I'm just asking all the questions, like, what in the hell are you doing that for?
Yeah. So let's maybe talk about roles and stuff, right? Because, like, front-end developers or front-end engineers or JavaScript engineers or JavaScript developers, is there any difference? And is there any – does it matter?
What do you want to be called, Mark?
Hey, you know, I like the term front-end developer.
And that's someone who's doing lots of CSS and JavaScript on the front-end client-side stuff?
Yeah, I mean, different places come up with different terms, and, you know, how do you compare them against each other? Front-end developer, I think the trickier thing is that there has definitely been a trend towards people who are very good at working with both server-side JavaScript and complex JavaScript frameworks, and who are awesome at that, which is great. And you also have a group of people that are awesome at working with HTML and CSS and probably using some JavaScript for behavior changes, but not to the same level where you're using the JavaScript to, you know, do the basic rendering of the page, like generating the markup and that sort of thing. And I don't think there's a real standardized way to describe mm-hmm. those differences yet. I don't know that JavaScript, I haven't really seen, maybe JavaScript developer, but I haven't really seen that used consistently. So, but could it be useful to have a differentiation between those two, which, you know, each set of skills I think is equally important in their own way.
Yeah, I guess it's not standardized is because people aren't standardized, you know, mm-hmm. like, there are certain people that like really have an in-depth knowledge of CSS, and I think I'm at that point right now, but I can also tell you probably 3 years ago, I thought I was at that point, and I can look at myself back then and be like, oh man, I just didn't know this, that, or the other. And I wonder what, you know, what the 2020 version of my Kershaw is going to say about me right now. I'm like, why did you do this? Slap. And
I think that's true of anybody, though. If you know, if you're not growing, then yeah. I mean, we all grow and learn and deepen our knowledge. You don't have to know every single one thing. Like having a good understanding of the fundamentals of things, and then knowing how to Google efficiently is right. Like that's what you need to be able to do.
Nonsense! I've been perfect since I was born. It's just been a perfect break.
So what is the title for a perfect person, Wes? Yeah.
I don't know.
They just call him Wes.
Yeah, they just call him Wes. Yeah.
Actually, I wanted to throw a little story out. I was on my current project. I had one of the client's developers remoting in with me, you know, because they were a backend developer trying to write some front end code, and you know, it was honestly nothing too crazy, but it was like using SAS, and they were a little bit lost, and I was kind of walking them through it, and then I was sharing my screen at the time, and I had like the MDN page up for background position because I always forget if it's like vertical, horizontal, or horizontal, vertical, and then when you do the offsets, and he's like, what are you doing looking that up? You should know that. And I'm like, no, you don't ever know the details. You just know when to use it.
Yeah. What, you know? Why use your brain space for, I mean, if it gets into your brain, that's fine, but like an MDN is, which is Mozilla Developer Network for people unfamiliar with that. They have some of the best documentation out there for HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. It's great.
Yeah. I also, getting back to job titles, I would like to bring back webmaster. Like, to me, that just sounds so freaking awesome. So
out of here. Yeah. Just get out.
That's, they call me a webmaster.
So I'll agree with you on the rote memory.
And the webmaster?
No, nope. Memorizing all those things is useless, but you know, after doing this for like, I don't know, 10, 13 years, I've been writing, you know, HTML, CSS. A lot of that stuff is stuck around in my head finally. But so my stance on the positions thing is I feel like there's the way I divide it is, what are you most concerned with? Because that's going to lead to the types of problems you're used to solving. So for me, the words, when I say front-end developer, I mean people that are like DOM wizards. Like they know how a web page renders, and they know things about accessibility, and they happen to write HTML, CSS, and usually JavaScript. But I don't even think that's a requirement, because that, you know, some people are maybe more on the design side, and less on the code side, and that's fine. I think you're still a front-end developer, you know, in my kind of definition of the thing. But then there's this other side that I call like front-end engineers, where they're more, they think about applications more. So this is like the kind of NPM node people that, you know, write things that have more complex logic. And it's more about, you know, kind of how a system fits together. And it kind of seems back-endy, but it's kind of not. And I don't really care about the word front-end too much. But, you know, they are still, I think a lot of people get caught up on the language that you're writing. But, I've seen, you know, people that are typically back-end developers get really good at NPM node stuff because they know how to solve the problems, and the language is just window dressing, right? So yeah, that's kind of how I break it down. And, you know, I think it's, I'm not sure that I'll ever be really good at setting up a Node application, like, or setting up a React website. Like that's something I want to learn, but I don't know that it's going to be like something that Lullabot has me do, you know, whenever they get a chance, like, oh, Wes, go set up this React site, you know? And like, I could probably figure it out with help from our coworkers and whatever, but yeah, I feel like they are like two separate mindsets that I've seen emerge.
So, it's definitely two different mindsets. Like I can definitely say that. Just out of curiosity, Mark and Wes, are both of you self-taught? I can tell you that I am.
Definitely.
Yeah. You too, Mark?
Yeah. You know, it's a mix. I've done a lot of self-learning. I also got, you know, a couple degrees in web design and graphic design stuff after college at a technical college. Nice. And it's just ongoing self-learning since then. You know, yeah. I think we all have to be self-taught unless we're always in school, because it's just going to keep changing.
Yeah. So that's a great transition there. How do we keep on top of stuff? I can tell you currently what I'm doing and like what's new. So let's talk about like keeping on top of new things like CSS Grid or Flexbox, or like, of course, all these JavaScript changes, like all the ES6 changes and new browser APIs and stuff like that. How do you learn those? Because those were not around 3 years ago.
First of all, how do you know something new exists?
Yeah.
Twitter.
That's a good question.
What are the unknown unknowns?
The other thing that's been really helpful is just like, thank goodness for Stack Overflow. It's just like, I want to do this. And then I just, you know, stick on like HTML or JavaScript or like some language or concept. And then like some Stack Overflow thing will come. Like, oh yeah, there's this whole browser API for that. And it's, you know, I'm just amazed at the information I can get out with some of the most random kind of queries. Like if this were Alta Vista days, I'd be screwed.
Yeah. But, yeah. There are so many new, like you said, like browser APIs, like Fetch, and like even like some of like the array APIs and like methods that are in there. And for me, like I'm doing a combination of things. You know, I'm taking some online ES6 courses. I'm doing like the ES6 IO West Boss course right now, and going to move into React course and stuff like that.
West
and,
Bright.
And I highly recommend it. So that's teaching me like a good amount, but definitely not everything. I get into topics that is just like touched on, and I'll full on go to the MDN docs and see stuff and explore. I also have a couple projects up on GitHub that I'm actually doing with my daughter. So there's like one where she makes silly sounds, another one where we do like an artboard, we play tic-tac-toe and stuff. And so I'm continuously refactoring those with like different things, and that's kind of fun. And so as I learn about something, I'll implement that into those projects, and that gives me a little bit of a real world skill. Another thing that I do is like looking at developer tools. Like we talked a little bit about Chrome developer tools. When you're in your sources panel and you're kind of expanding, you know, whatever array you have or whatever you're looking at, you can look at the methods under those, and those methods are usually pretty semantic. You know, like there's a find method on the array, you know, or there's a filter method or something like that, and then you can figure out stuff like that. But for me, that's it. I think the biggest thing is just doing it, you know. The more you do it, and then you end up Googling it, and then you end up on Stack Overflow, and then you find out something, and then you know about something, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. No, I'd put it into very similar categories, like Wes, you know, Twitter for the, like, just seeing things mentioned and saying, oh, that's something I might want to know about. And then the other thing is when I go to a conference or something, I found one of the most effective things to do at a conference is just go to sessions that I don't really know anything about, rather than going to sessions that I definitely know things about and I might learn like an inch or two more of something, you know, like going to something where I'm not really familiar with this thing just to like learn the vocabulary of it. I think that ends up being really useful. And then like on Twitter, as I'm learning, as I'm like kind of just doing things, I'll fave articles. And then I have, I use this tool pinboard.in, and I have an if then this then that that saves all my links that I fave to there. And so then I'll just go on a binge. Like it doesn't happen all that often. But like the spring, that's how, when I wanted to learn about grid stuff, like I found I had like 30 or 40 articles and I just went through a binge and I just read all of them to like really kind of try to get some more in-depth knowledge of something. And that was very helpful. And then turning that into something, like you said, like a project, an experiment, something to solidify that knowledge, I think can be really helpful. Yeah. And then just combined with the looking stuff up as you're going along, you know, where you need to, like, you've got this one really tricky problem you're working on in a project. And so, okay, well, I need to take a couple hours or half day to try to really figure this out. And then, you know, hopefully it kind of sticks for next time.
Yeah. So, I'd repeat everything that was said, but my addition to this would be mentoring. I do a lot of mentoring, and when you have to teach someone else something, yeah. Oh my goodness, I learned so much. I learned, you know, more communication skills are always great. Understanding where disconnects happen when you're talking to people, whether it's something technical, yeah, or just trying to get them to understand something. But then, you know, I'm mentoring someone right now, learning Drupal, and he wants to learn Drupal 8. And I know enough to be dangerous, but, you know, and obviously I know a lot about Drupal historically, but, I have learned so much about Drupal 8 just by, you know, helping someone build a fairly simple site. It has taught me a ton, because he's just running into all sorts of issues and he hasn't used Drupal at all, before, you know, maybe a year ago. So I think that stuff is really important, and bonus, you get to help another human maybe make a living, mm-hmm, or something like that. So that's, yeah, always good. But awesome. The other thing I would say is when you pick a project, I always try to make my projects, I recommend to my mentees and then for myself, make the project like as real as possible. So like you actually have a goal and like, you know, there's something you're working towards and there are requirements you can flesh out, but you don't, mm-hmm, want it to be so important to you that you end up focusing on something that's not learning the thing you're trying to learn, like making a website for yourself. Terrible, terrible. Because then you worry about, is this the right branding for me when you're trying to learn HTML and CSS or something like that?
Yeah. Another thing on the lines of mentoring is giving a talk on a topic. Like once you you have a certain amount of knowledge about something, because I mean, prepping a talk, it's usually, you know, depends on the length, but what, 30, 40 hours, 80 hours? It's a lot of time that you have to put in to get a talk ready. And then just the act of giving it and finding, how do I explain this effectively? You know, writing an article is another way to do that, to just, yeah, being able to explain something to somebody else, I think is huge.
Yeah, I run our local Gainesville, Florida front end developer meetup, and like it's really kind of loose, and so I will frequently get up after like the main presentation and explain something that I'm just learning, mm-hmm, and what'll happen is people will often correct me, you know, but at the same time I'm learning and I have fun doing it. It's kind of a safe space where I don't feel like I'm being too much of a fool, because it's a bunch, yeah, of friends. So that's a good environment. If you can find something like that, it's really awesome.
Yeah. We do show and tells here at Lullabot where, you know, everybody take 15, 20 minutes to show something. And that's perfect for that sort of thing too.
And Lullabot show and tells are specifically not recorded. And they're not recorded just so people are not under that pressure that this is going to live forever or something like that. And it makes everybody a little bit more willing to, you know, talk about whatever they're working on, even if they might not have the best solution, or if they're not 100% confident, you know, because it's tough to get in front of a bunch of smart people like Mark and Wes and everyone else and say, hey, this is what I'm doing. You know, you always have that voice in the back of your head, like, these people are judging me, you know, yeah. and So that's
the other thing that I'm really loving that we're doing right now is that, you know, we have a JS study group going on at Lullabot that Sally Young and others have worked to put together, where we've got different exercises that we're working on each week. And we you know, work on them. We submit a pull request. We get some feedback from our more experienced coworkers, and then we talk about it a little bit each week. And there's a really wide variety of people that are participating in that.
Yeah.
You know, from people on our design team, which is great, and it's a really good way to learn is with other people.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, even Matt Westgate, our Lullabot CEO, is participating, which is, like, pretty awesome. And he's you know, he's a former developer, so he's kind of learning, like, the newfangled stuff.
Yep.
So that's pretty cool. As far as the newfangled stuff goes, what kinds of things are out there that you know exist that you're just itching to work with?
CSS Grid. For sure. I'd like to work with it on a client project, hopefully.
Tell me about that a little bit. I know we mentioned it before. So this is a grid system that's like native CSS that a browser supports. Is that the deal? I'm making it up based on what I'm using the context clues to determine what we're talking
about. So Flexbox is fantastic, and this doesn't replace Flexbox. I think that's really important to understand. It's a parallel thing. Flexbox is fantastic, as Wes mentioned earlier, for like a one-dimensional layout for a row of something. Mm-hmm. But for something that's two-dimensional, where you need to be able to place things both vertically and horizontally, CSS Grid is fantastic. And it allows you to have elements automatically layout in a grid where you set up the rules for where things will show up, or you can manually place things in a certain grid cell. And like out of the box, like the browsers have been really cooperating with each other so that, bam, hey, there's really good browser support right from the start, rather than maybe 5 years from now you can use it. No, you can use it now. So that's something I'm really excited about. And I'd say the other thing I'm most excited about is HTTP2.
Yeah.
Which is a new way, a new protocol for how servers send their resources to a browser and how the two of them communicate. But that is going to have a really big impact, I think, for the front end in terms of how we optimize front end performance, which is something I care a lot about. And so I'd love to, it'd be fun to be able to do that on a project. And because that's the other way you learn is like, some of the stuff you just can't learn until you're working on it on a regular basis. Like, yeah. So,
Wes, what are you looking forward to learning?
I echo CSS Grid. Everything you loved about tables and everything you loved about CSS in one place.
that is a great, great description right there.
Yeah. And it's one of the first CSS things that really gets us away from DOM order. Let's see. I want to do more React stuff, and not even necessarily for like stuff that that would apply to my job. I have like this board game or card game scorekeeping app I've been sitting on forever. I just want to build an application and figure out the concerns there and what you do, because it just seems very interesting to be able to do that with a system like React, where I'm kind of doing back-end and front-end with one language, and it can work locally or, you know, on the server. Being able to do things like, you know, you could just download it and then like keep score right there, or you could like save the score, it goes to the server, and then you pick up the game later, maybe on a different machine, or like you could have multiple people keeping score and they're both kept in sync. Just, you know, those kinds of things really fascinate me, and it's all without reloading pages, right? So that stuff seems really fun to me. Trying to think if there's anything else. I've become a little bit curmudgeonly with CSS, and I don't use SAS anymore.
Wait a minute.
You're a hipster.
Do you have just a bunch of individual CSS files that don't have the SAS nesting? And like, what are you doing?
Since Drupal aggregates the CSS files, that's really the only thing I care about. I like to be able to organize CSS files the way I want and have a lot of them, like per component. But it's been such a pain for a lot of people that I haven't been able to, and I figured out how to use auto prefixer on my end without needing a compile process. And so it's like, you know what? I don't need it. I haven't needed it for a while. I'm not saying it's like bad or wrong, but it's just like, it's not necessary anymore. I've figured out all the benefits that it gave me. I pretty much have, so I don't worry about it. And I'm not using auto prefix or anything to do anything crazy. I'm just writing vanilla CSS, and then it's giving me all the browser prefixes, which I don't want to commit to my memory at all, ever.
And we haven't mentioned auto prefixer. So real quick, for people who haven't encountered it, auto prefixer is a process that can run through your CSS, and like Wes said, it just adds in all the vendor prefixes like -moz, -webkit, that sort of thing, so that you don't have to do it yourself, because who wants to do that? And you can specify, I want all the vendor prefixes that are needed for the last two versions of current browsers.
Yeah.
And then I also want IE11, for example.
Yep. So, and the way I figured out how to use it is you install it as a package to your editor, and then you just, I press Command or Control Shift P, and then type in auto prefix and press Enter, and it just runs. And I'm like, all right, well, I'll just commit that CSS. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So it's just on me. I don't have to like stress out. I have one SysOps guy right now that's working on at least 12 websites, and like he just doesn't need that stress
of
the compile process. So
that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And I don't have to worry about compiled versus non-compiled. It's just, you know, it's more straightforward.
Neat. Right. To answer the question, I'm going to jump in on this one too, because I'm having fun learning. Like right now I'm learning a lot of JavaScript stuff, and I'm having a lot of fun doing it. And I want to kind of continue on to like maybe some decoupled stuff. I would love to be developing against decoupled Drupal or something like that.
Contenta.
Contenta. Contenta, which will be an upcoming podcast. Contenta is a decoupled Drupal distribution that basically like has a really nice back end, abstracts some Drupal, has the full power of Drupal, but then just spits out all these types of really, really nice formatted JSON, and allows front end applications or front end anything really to ingest that and, you know, kind of work with it. So I would like to do that. I'm really interested in Vue.js, which is like in kind of in the same vein of like Ember, React, or Angular, or something like that. And I like it because right now I've barely started learning it, so I'm definitely not an expert, but it has almost like a vanilla JavaScripty feel. You know, it doesn't have like a lot of the abstractions that React does, at least from what I can see so far. But that all being said, like a lot of Lullabot's projects are React based. And, you know, I feel like if I got really into React, that would be good for Lullabot. So honestly, I'd love to learn them both, you know. But at the same time, you can't learn everything, you know.
You got to pick.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the other thing I'd say is I got to work on a Drupal 8 project for good, I don't know, 9 months or so. And that was great. And I think that all the decoupled stuff is cool, and it'd be neat to work on one of those. But I also look forward to the next chance to get into work, just with Drupal 8's theme system. I thought it was really good to work with, and I'd enjoy doing that again, working with Twig and that sort of thing. So,
I definitely agree with that. So. One more question, just like to keep it really quick before we finish this up. Do you have any favorite front-end developers? You can name one or two, starting with maybe Mark, and I'll put you on the spot, Mark. And it's okay if the answer is Wes and me. That's completely cool.
No. Susan Robertson is one that I'm a mm-hmm. fan of. She's out in Oregon and really excellent, awesome skills with HTML and CSS and accessibility. The technical college I went to, MCTC, she was in the classes at the same time as me. And but great person. Mina Markham, she's pretty awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot.
There's a couple.
Yep. About you, Wes?
This is a hard question. Yeah, there's a bunch of people I follow on Twitter that that pop mm-hmm. up a lot. I don't know if I can remember their actual names though. But accessibility stuff has been something I've been interested in a lot. Helena Sue, what's her last name now?
McCabe.
Helena McCabe. Yep. Helena McCabe, our very own Lilabot, she's been teaching me a lot. And then, Marcy Sutton and mm-hmm. There's some other people. There's a guy, I can't think of his name, but there's a lot of people that tweet about that I really enjoy. And then actually there's one other person who's been writing some articles on Medium. Oh, man. I'm going to find his name real quick, and then maybe I'll be able to yell it out or put it in the show notes or something.
Laura Kalbeg has a new accessibility book coming out with A Book Apart. That's cool.
Mike, do you have any? Who are your favorites, Mike Herschel?
I have like many, like Chris Coyer, who runs CSS Tricks. I've learned a lot from that website. One that like comes to mind is David Walsh, who's a senior like a front-end person at Mozilla, and he has just like a really, really awesome blog where he explains like different JavaScript concepts and a lot of really good stuff, and I really, really enjoy that. And then, of course, there's all like the Chromium devs, like Paul Irish and like Adi Asmani and stuff like that, that I end up learning a lot from, and all those people are pretty important from learning from, so yeah. And of course, like number one would be like maybe like a tie between Mark Drummond and Wes.
Mike Herschel's way in the bottom of my. No, just kidding.
You can go to hell, Wes.
The guy I was looking for is David Gilbertson. He wrote 11 Things I Learned About Reading the Flexbox Spec, and he also wrote an article about mini React patterns, and they were both like mind-blowingly good. And then he wrote something about CSS that I vehemently disagreed with, but I still enjoyed it.
Cool. Oh, and yeah, I just mentioned again Jen Simmons and Rachel Andrew. They've been doing awesome stuff with CSS Grid, and like if you like front-end development, you should really follow them on Twitter because they've got some really good stuff to share.
Thanks, Wes and Mark, for coming on and talking shop for a little while.
Do you feel a little bit more comfortable?
No.
The next time you walk into the very nice and clean and orderly and easily understandable front end for a project,
it'll
just all
so
be
let's
like,
talk about that for one it. Second, Mark. I can call you out publicly. So we were on a project and I was given a front end ticket and I'm like, well, shit, this is going to be fun because I haven't done one of these in a while. So I looked at it and it was actually very simple. It's like, oh, well, this is just a Z index thing and it's a 10 and I can make it 11 and it's, and it works great. I did it locally. It's good. Made the pull request, checked it in, and it wasn't good enough for Mark.
Well,
so he had to go back and review it. And, I was tempted. Instead of making it a 10, a Z index 10 to a Z index 11, I wanted to make it 1,000 and just check that in.
Right. And that would have broken things.
No, it wouldn't. It would have worked just fine. It would have broken your brain, but, it would have been okay.
It would have shown up above some other elements that needed to have a higher Z index than that particular element.
Well, but I could have gone to 2,000 with them then, right?
I was having this scope problem in PHP. Yeah. I was just going to make it a global variable. Is that okay?
Yeah, it works fine.
In hindsight, after I further looked at that particular ticket, my memory of the Z index of the higher element was wrong, and your answer was absolutely spot on. And so you were right there.
You actually changed. You added another Z index of another element to zero, if I recall correctly.
So that to remove any possibility that it would cause a problem in the future. So Z index stuff is really tricky. That is one of trickier areas of CSS.
It really is.
I think we need to have a podcast on positioning in Z index. I think right now we're kind of going over
Z index 3 million.
Please do not.
Front-end developers use so many tools, it's so complicated.